Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day, and our horticulture experts are that. They are experts. They all draw on a great deal of knowledge and experience in answering your questions, but every once in a while, we run into a question they can't answer, and then the ISU Extension Horticulture Specialist, Richard Geron, will tell the caller to send in a sample. This hour, we're going to start off with the people who receive those samples at the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. Laura Iles is here. She is director of the clinic. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
And Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca is here. She's an extension plant pathologist and diagnostician. Hello, Lena.
Hello.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
And all right, let's start out with that moment when Richard says you need to send in a sample.
And I say that often,
you
actually.
Not because you don't know a great deal, Richard, but there are tricky questions out there. All right, when somebody gets to the point where they have a problem, they can't figure out the answer, they need to send in a sample. I mean, Laura, give me kind of an overview of the kinds of things that people need you to identify, what you're looking for in a sample.
Right. So one of our major services is we call them just plant problem diagnoses. So this is where plant material is coming into us and we're looking for insects, we're looking for plant diseases, we're looking for signs of maybe abiotic stress or something else occurring in that. So that's kind of one thing we do, kind of diagnose why the plant is not looking so good. And then we also just do insect identifications. We do mushroom identifications. We also deal a lot with nematodes and plant identifications.
All right. And when somebody needs to get your help, is it a good idea for them to talk to you before they try to send in a sample?
Well, we have a lot of information on our website, clinic.ipm.iastate.edu. And so, you know, if you have good internet access, you're welcome to go there. We've got lots of how to submit things. You're certainly welcome to call us at, you know, if you don't know, it's better to call us, find out what we need. We're at 515-294-0581. And we're just happy to help you kind of find out what sort of sample we need for to do a good diagnosis.
All right. And if somebody does send in a sample, it has to give you enough material to work with. How do you tell people to prepare samples?
You know, sometimes it depends on what sort of plant it is. For things that are like, you know, this time of year, if a tomato plant's not looking very good, we would ask that you would send in, you know, three or four whole plants if you can. Things like tomatoes, having the roots travel with them helps a lot. You know, we understand a tree, you can't send us all the roots, but I always say if you can fit your whole tree in like a little sandwich bag, the sample, we're not going to be able to tell much from three or four leaves from a whole tree. But, you know, so give us several branches and things like that. But sometimes we're wanting to test for specific pathogens and we might need, you know, some branches and things like that. So sometimes that's why if you're really not sure, getting in touch with us first can really help a lot to help us get the right sample for you.
All right. And Lena, let's say you get in three tomato plants. Somebody doesn't know why they're not performing well. How do you research that? What kind of sleuthing do you do?
Well, the first thing is I do a complete examination. It's a lot like, you know, physician work. I looked at the roots of the plants, any symptoms. What are the visible changes on the plant, on the leaves? Is it discolor? Is there spots? And what the symptoms are fitting with a particular key problems in tomato, or if it may be something completely new or something that I have never seen before. And we also consult with a lot of people, too, because there are things that, you know, may not be within the plant disease world. I may need to go and talk to horticulturalist, agronomist. But then from there, if I'm suspecting, for example, a leaf spot, then I will look at those spots under the microscope and look for parts of the pathogen. Or if I'm looking for the symptoms are matching of a vascular pathogen that is kind of like blocking the system, the vascular system of a plant, then I will conduct some isolations. And that means that I will take chunks of that tissue and put it on a Petri plate that has media. So pretty much what I'm doing is giving the pathogen what it likes to eat on that media so that it will grow there.
And then how long does it take to develop one of those samples?
So if it's a fungal pathogen, it normally takes 1 to 2 weeks. If it's a bacterial pathogen, it could be 3 to 5 days. And it really depends on what pathogen I'm looking to isolate, because there are pathogens that grow really slow, and I need the full 2 weeks for them to develop the structures that I can use to identify them.
Now, why is it important? Let's say I have trouble with my tomatoes in my garden. If, you know, it's going to take 2 weeks to figure out what's going on, that ship has probably sailed in many ways. Why is it important to figure out what's going on?
Well, I'll give you an example. There are vascular pathogens that stay in the soil, and that will impact whatever you're going to plant next year, because if you are not rotating with a crop that is non-susceptible, you may get this problem over and over again. So that information of knowing what pathogen was in the vascular system of your plant will guide you on what plant you should have in your garden or in your landscape, too, in the following years.
Now, we talked about sending in samples. Laura, of course, technology has connected us in new ways. Digital pictures are so much better than they once were. Is that helpful if somebody can send in a photo, or can you just not see what you need to see?
No, photos are great for us to see the whole plant, especially trees, and it really helps with our recommendations, you know, whether or not it looks like this tree is worth treating with a fungicide or an insecticide, or if it looks like, you know, it's so stressed. We can't just identify the problem from a photo, unfortunately. We can't, you know, see the insects. We can't obviously see fungal structures and things like that. So we can't really diagnose your problem and give you good recommendations from a photo. But the photos are, we love photos because that really helps us, you know, and a lot of people send us photos before the sample, and we can look at the photos and say, okay, from looking at your, you know, the situation, we want, you know, this sort of sample. And so photos are a great way to communicate back and forth. Great tool.
How do you keep track of things over time? I can assume that if somebody's having a problem, that somebody else in Iowa may also be having the same problem. Do you map the samples that you get?
Sure. So all the samples that we get, we assign everything a unique number. We document with lots of pictures the sample coming in. Everything is very well documented. We report all our diagnoses up to a National Plant Diagnostic Network. So there's a national database of all the diseases and insects that are coming into clinics as well. So it's part of a kind of a vast network tracking any potential problems. And that's how we pick up any invasive or new and emerging diseases and insects. So very important.
Lena, can you give me an example of something that was extremely difficult for you to identify? I imagine your job is a little bit of a detective.
Yeah, I think the harder ones are, you know, when you may think that trees are hard, for example, because sometimes people will send us very small amounts of tissue of plant material, and then we're trying to look for, you know, okay, what may be there. And it's hard to contact the client and maybe ask for some pictures. And it's hard because there are things that we don't see underground. So I struggle when the site is not right or the tree has been planted very deep. I keep looking in the sample and I can't find anything. And then finally they send me a picture and I'm like, oh, maybe you want to, you know, I don't see the flare in the trunk. Let's look at the roots, but this may be something serious with the tree. Those are the hardest ones for me because I, you know, my world, I live in the world of microscopic little things that I look under the microscope. And when I don't find anything and I have to start looking for other answers, it kind of goes away from my comfort zone.
Now, we often have DNR District Forester Mark Vitosh here on the show. And of course, when somebody's having trouble with their trees, they often call him and say, hey, come look at our tree. Do you coordinate with the people who are out in the field too?
I call them too. I send them photos. Absolutely, yes. And also extension personnel and agriculturalists that help us with all these types of consultations that we may need.
So what are you seeing? I'd love to hear from both of you. What are some of the trends you're seeing so far this spring?
Well, we already have our first apple scab. Scab is one that is common in crab apples, pears, in apples. That's what we're seeing for that. Maples, we had some anthracnose on the leaves. Some people concerned about verticillium, so we're just starting to test on those. What else have we had so far? So we had a lot of rain on a particular week, and so some tomatoes and vegetable gardens in general are starting to show some yellowing on the bottom leaves and some leaf spots. And so I'm pretty sure you know, we had some nutritional deficiencies going on, but I'm sure septoria and the bottom leaves will start to pop up pretty soon. So far, we just have alternaria confirmed.
So while the rest of us are thinking about the growing season in terms of, you know, when we plant and when we can start to harvest, do you sort of map out the growing season in plant pathology terms, imagining when the different diseases are going to pop up?
Not quite. There is a key ones that I know where things are going to start popping up. So right now, for example, in our Hort page, we have an announcement that talks about oak wilt. We want people to think about not pruning their oak wilt, the oaks, so that we avoid oak wilt moving into freshly pruned oaks. And this will be until the 1st of July that the risk is high. So there are things that definitely pop up at certain times in the year, but it also depends on the weather that we have. You know, how pathogens love rain, temperatures that are mild to high, and a lot of humidity in the morning. So it really depends on the type of season that we have. We had, you know, if we happen to have a drought, then things are completely different for my season because I then don't see a lot of things. Well, it's completely different for Laura because insects love that heat.
Well, and Laura, we're going to have to take a break here, but you can start. What are some of the insect issues we're starting to see?
We got a lot of oak galls this year. We got gouty oak gall and some woolly oak galls. So this has been kind of a fun year with getting these galls that are caused by little wasps just laying eggs and feeding on the trees and causing these really unique and, to me, very beautiful shapes on the oak leaves and the oak branches. But
and those are typically things that aren't going to cause the tree much trouble, right?
No, and so, like the horned oak gall, and you can look this up, they can get really heavy and cause branch splitting, but there's not much you can do about it. So, yeah, you do have to kind of learn to love that unique look to your tree.
All right. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. And, of course, Laura and Lena will answer your questions. Richard Duran is also in the studio. He will answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Laura Iles, director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic, and Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca, extension plant pathologist and diagnostician. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, we have experts from the Iowa State University Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Laura Iles is director of the clinic. Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca is an extension plant pathologist and diagnostician. They can talk about insects and plant diseases as well. Richard Duran is also here, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And of course, we already have people with questions. Here's a question from Lori in Des Moines. I have a tree in the backyard that we recently moved to. It's an older home, and this tree is very large. I believe it's a locust, but it's very messy. Will it be messy all summer or just in the spring? I'll let you answer that one first, Richard.
Well, if it's a honey locust, it does bloom in the spring. The flowers are not showy. They're small. They're very green. I have one myself. And so these flowers fall to the ground. And so they'll get into gutters. They'll get onto patios and decks. So they can be a little bit messy. But they only do that in the spring of the year. They do lose their leaves in the fall and usually pretty early. And you have these small leaflets, and if they're near the house, if they're wet, they'll track in on your shoes, so they can be a little messy there too. But overall, not too messy, no.
All right. And she has another question. It has a Y about 10 feet up, and the previous owners have put a heavy-duty chain around the Y. I guess to keep it from splitting, should we just allow the chain to stay or try to remove it? It may have grown into the tree itself.
Well, if it's grown into the tree itself, I would leave it. But if it hasn't, I'd replace it. I would contact an arborist and have them come out. And if it needs to be supported, they'll put rods through the tree and remove that chain.
All right. Let's go to the phones. The number 866-780-9100. Rihanna is on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Rihanna.
Hi. I have a peony that I foolishly planted in completely the wrong place. The situation now is there is a large wild rose to one side of it and a getting large lilac to the other side of it, and the blossoms are reaching forward for the light in its dark cave. So my question is, what do I need to pay attention to in digging it up and moving it? Can it be moved to full sun? What do I need to know?
Well, the peony actually does transplant fairly easily, but I would wait until basically mid to late September. Then at that point, I would cut it back to the ground, and then get a shovel or a spade, dig it up, try to include a nice ball of dirt around the root system, and replant immediately, and plant in an area that receives at least 6 hours of direct sun and has a well-drained soil, watered in nicely. Water periodically in the fall, and it should be fine the next year.
All right, and since you're cutting it back to the ground when you transplant it, are you expecting more greenery to grow before winter?
No, it's just easier to move at that point. We typically want to wait till September so that the foliage can manufacture food all summer long. So by mid to late September, it's basically ready for next year. And so you can cut it back at that point and transplant it.
All right. And of course, peonies are just finishing their bloom. And I think it's been a terrific year for peonies.
It has been. Yes.
Although, of course, we did have a big wind and
rain.
Storm.
Right. And they flop over, yes.
Of course. But so I'm sure there are probably a lot of people who are thinking, I wish my peonies maybe were in a different place. What's an ideal spot for peonies?
Ideal spot is, again, pretty simple. A well-drained soil. They don't like wet, poorly drained sites. And at least 6 hours of direct sun. If they have those two things, they're fine, and they can be left undisturbed for 50, 60, 70 years.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. John is on the line in Corning. Hi, John.
Hello. I am calling with a question about any other prohibitions for pruning other than oak trees after, say, this time of the year.
Okay. And you're just strictly talking about trees at this point?
Correct.
All right.
No real prohibitions on that. Basically, you can prune almost any time during the year. The worst times to prune most trees would be in the spring as they're leafing out and in the fall as they're shedding their foliage. So late winter typically is a good time to prune most trees. Actually, midsummer is a good time to prune trees if you need to. So no real prohibitions at this point.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. No oak pruning, but...
Right.
You're okay. All right. RV is up next in Fort Dodge. Hi, RV.
Good morning. My question, we lost a bunch of trees here from that bad storm, and I lost about a 35 or 40-foot blue spruce, and I have availability of a tree spade.
Mm-hmm.
The trees that I can transplant are going to be between 10 and 15 feet tall, so I don't believe I have an issue. But can I use a tree spade anytime during the year, or do you want to wait to the fall or something before you transplant something?
Well, I wouldn't do it during the heat of the summer. So I wouldn't be doing this, let's say, late June, July, into early August. It can be difficult because when you dig up the tree, you are cutting off some of the root system. And if we have a prolonged, hot, dry period, it's going to be hard for that tree to absorb enough water, even though you keep it well watered. So I probably wouldn't do it in the heat of the summer. I think late summer is a good time, like late August, early September, because by then the weather is moderating. We shouldn't have any extreme events as far as weather-wise, but it does give the tree a few weeks to get established before winter. So that's a pretty good time. And then very early in the spring is also a very good time.
Just one more question. When I built a berm and put these trees in when they were little, and then, of course, they just did great. Let's say the berm is at least 6 feet high and the angle is close to 45 degree angle. Does that present a problem for a tree spade?
Well, it can, because you're putting it on a slope. Basically, the thing is, when you do that, you want to make sure that the majority of that root ball goes in the ground and it's not left exposed. That's the main thing.
All right. Great answers. Thank you for your help.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, RV. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Alice is up next in Ames. Hi, Alice.
Yes. I have a question about mildew on a peony. It is just covered with mildew. Is it best to cut off the foliage entirely, dig it up? Treat it. What are my options?
And are we talking a white, powdery look?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
So it's most likely powdery mildew. I think what we have to think about here is how those pathogens live, and they stay on debris. So it will be important to try and at the end of the season clean up your peonies beds so that there's none of the overwintering structures of the pathogen left for next year. But it's a very common disease in peonies that is hard to really control with fungicides. It's more about that sanitation, that cleaning up the infected tissue.
And also the site is very important, too. We tend to see a lot more powdery mildew, let's say, in part sun or part shade. So if they're in part sun, part shade, if you have a really, really sunny location, you might want to move it there. But in part sun, part shade, it's much more severe. Also, the weather is a factor, too. So some years it's really bad, some years not so much. But we didn't really see this 20, 25 years ago. It's been a really fairly recent thing in the last 5 or 10 years. Very common nowadays, though.
So does it stay in the soil or anything like that? So it's just really only clean up on the upper in fall. Just leave it because it's already touching some other ones and passing to that.
Yeah, not in the soil per se, but associated with any leaf tissue and any debris that will stay after the fall.
Okay, so I will just wait until fall and then clean it up.
Yep, or try to move them to a better location.
Very good. Thank you much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Alice. Is there a concern that if you do move them to a new location that it needs to be far enough from where the original location was?
Not so much. Just make sure it has a lot of sun. That's the main thing. Where you have partial shade, poor air circulation, the conditions are more favorable for the powdery mildew. In a sunny spot where you have good air circulation, not so much.
All right, 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Laura, way back before the break, we were talking about insect trends you were seeing this spring. Are you already getting reports on the emerald ash borer?
It's quiet now for emerald ash borer. We're still a little too cold. Of course, the larvae are out there, so we're getting reports of, you know, suspect ash trees that we, of course, follow up for, you know, looking for that tunneling and things like that. So a lot of it's more about kind of talking to people about, you know, if they want to treat their ash tree and, you know, if so, what are the options?
Are there other invasive insects that you're also keeping your eye on?
I've kind of got my eye out for a viburnum leaf beetle this year. It's been reported in a couple of counties in Illinois. So if you have a viburnum this spring that's kind of got a lot of holes in it, please let me know. So that's kind of more of a curiosity one. Of course, brown marmorated stink bug is one that we're still watching for that, you know, we've gotten a number of reports from this spring just because it's a household accidental invader. So there's always kind of a few that we're keeping an eye out for.
All right. And of course, we haven't seen the Japanese beetles yet.
Let's hope it's another sort of quiet year. Western Iowa was, we had some pockets last year, but for most of us, it wasn't too bad. So curious to see what this year will hold.
All right. Back to the phones. We've got Mike on the line in Waterloo with a bug question. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I have found a colony of bugs in the yard. They have burrowed into the dirt, and there's mounds around their burrows. and I see this little metallic bug down there. Do you have any idea what it might be?
So do you think they're ants or wasps? So we kind of got in
no,
the soil.
They're flying in and out.
So then we're probably...
I've never been able to get a picture of them or really a good look so I can try to look them up in a book. But when I go up to these burrows, you can see this little metallic green head kind of pointing out at you.
Oh, cute. I wish I could see this. So this sounds like one... Sorry. This sounds like
this
one...
This is the entomologist.
Yeah. So this is one of... We've got many species of kind of ground nesting wasps. They're generally... Each female builds her own nest. They do tend to do it in clusters, like what you're describing, but they're not really a colony. They don't tend to be aggressive at all, so they're not like our, you know, some of the yellow jackets and things that can, you know, are protecting a queen. So if they're not in an area that causes any disturbance, just, you know, kind of leave them alone. They're great. They're beneficial pollinators and certainly fun to have around.
Yeah, it's just a curiosity that I noticed.
Yep. So ground, one of the solitary ground nesting bees.
One other thing I have seen, I live in the country outside of Waterloo, and this morning I've seen three monarchs, which seems a little early.
You know, they're kind of right on time. It was kind of been a weird year where we had the warmth and then we had kind of unseasonably cold last week. And then now we're back to the warmth. But caterpillars have been spotted around Iowa. So if you're wanting to raise monarchs, now's the time to start checking all those milkweeds. And, you know, the common milkweed is up a foot or two in most areas.
Yep. But it's just fun to see them also.
Yeah. It is.
Thank you for your information. I'll look up some burrowing wasps.
All right, good luck with that, Mike. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Jeff in Des Moines. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. I have a question about a Rose of Sharon that I've had for, I think, 3 or 4, maybe even 5 years that has flourished.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't leafed out yet. There are some signs of little green life on some of the stems, but many of them are also gray and look like they've died off when they tried to sprout. Can I consider that a dead plant?
Not yet. The Rose of Sharon is kind of marginally hardy here in central Iowa. It typically will survive a typical winter, but if we have a extremely cold winter, it may not. But it also leaves out very, very late. So I would be concerned, but I would give it at least another 2 or 3 weeks. If you don't see anything by June 20th, you probably lost the plant.
Okay. And certainly wasn't a harsh winter.
No, it was not. It was a fairly mild winter, yes. So it doesn't quite make sense, no.
No, it's really, really done well in its first few years. I've just been amazed at how much it's grown and how healthy it is. But anyway, I'll keep an eye on it for a few more weeks and then maybe give up. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And next up, let's go to Maria in Des Moines. Hi, Maria.
Hi. I have 2 juniper trees that I planted in my front yard in 2008, and just over the past, 2.5 years, they progressively, one is way far worse than the other, just have these brown spots, and it looks like they're dying. And I was told it's because they weren't getting enough water during that really hot summer we had, 2 summers ago. But what do you think it could be?
I would have to discount the lack of water, because junipers are pretty tough, pretty reliable, so I'm guessing it's probably not that. I would be more concerned about maybe a tip light, Lena?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. And those are not...
What did you say it was? I'm sorry?
Perhaps a tip blight.
Tip?
So,
okay.
Tip blight?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So that's blight. The name of a symptom. And what happens is if there is a fungal pathogen present in there, then the tips of the tree will start kind of rapidly dying. That's what we call blight. And what we normally get when we get a sample is then we look for, you know, we put it in high humidity and we look for little fungal bodies so that we can confirm that it's actually a fungal pathogen causing the problem.
Okay. So what should I do? Should I just cut them down and put something else or what?
Well, I would recommend if you want to send us a sample, you can go to our website, theclinic.ipm.iastate.edu. We do have a lot of good information there on what type of sample to send us, and then we can confirm if that's the problem. You know, trees, especially the junipers, suffer from other things, a couple of fungi, and also some cankers. And if there are cankers, those are more serious, and then we normally recommend to remove the tree, but it really depends on what the problem is.
Okay. I would love to just get you guys to come here, like pay you to come to my house, because I have a lot of fruit trees. A couple of them are suffering too, and I just would like to get an opinion, pay someone to come, but you don't do that, do you?
We don't, but Richard has a publication on how to select an arborist that we recommend. So if you want someone to do that for you, depending on the county that you are, I think there are some extension offices that may be able to help, but not all of them. But no, unfortunately, we don't take that type of trip.
All right. So if you go to Iowa State University Extension and look up how to select an arborist, you should be able to find information that should lead you to somebody who can help you out with that. Maria, thank you so much for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We have experts today from the Iowa State University Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic with us. Entomologist Laura Iles is director of the clinic. Lena Rodriguez Salamanca is extension plant pathologist and diagnostician, plant doctor. And they are here to answer your questions. Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist, is also here. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Laura Iles, director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. Lena Rodriguez Salamanca is an extension plant pathologist and diagnostician at the clinic. And Richard Duran is here, Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist. We have a lot of callers on the line, so let's go to the phones. Jerry is on the line in Rhinebeck. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I've got particularly a locust tree, but also a Bradford pear and a lilac that something is tearing bark off of to quite an extent. It's almost girdled in a couple of branches, and I wonder what it could be and what I can do about it.
So are you seeing strips of bark on the ground?
No, they disappear.
Okay. My first thought would be squirrels. They'll do that on occasion.
A lot of squirrels.
And usually they just drop it on the ground, but sometimes they use it maybe to build their nest. So I would suspect probably squirrels. And there's not much you can do about that. That's just their habit. Usually it's something that's temporary where they don't do it long term, but they may do it for a while. They might cause quite a bit of damage and then stop. So I don't really have a good solution as far as controlling that.
Okay. Well, I'll try to keep an eye on them and keep them away if I can.
One thing you might do maybe is if they're doing this at a specific area, what you might maybe do is wrap that area with something so they can't physically do it anymore. At least they won't come back to that spot. They might go elsewhere or stop completely. So you might, if they're coming back to a certain area, like on the trunk, and doing it repeatedly, putting something around it, wrapping it with something so they can't do it in the future. Just a temporary solution.
All right, Jerry, thanks a lot for your call. And Bruce in Iowa City has a similar question. Did that help you out, Bruce?
Well, I'm concerned about ground squirrels.
Ah.
And they tear up our planters. They just tore up a couple of planters of coleus the other day.
Yeah.
Any advice?
Again, there's not much you can do on that. I guess maybe you could put the planters somewhere else for a while and then maybe bring them back at a time. Otherwise, there's not much you can do. I would discourage them. I wouldn't feed them or anything, but there's not much you can do.
No, and a couple of years ago, they took all our fruited tomatoes before we could get them.
Yeah, sometimes they'll eat things too. So, but usually it's a minor thing, and usually over time they go elsewhere or try something else. But there's not much you can do.
I was afraid. that. All right. Thanks so much, folks.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100. Mary Lee is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Mary Lee.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question is that we have found with blue rug junipers across a terrace, and parts of it are turning brown all the time. And local shops said, well, put some paper under it, under the branches, and tap gently and see if little black mites maybe are falling off. And we did see some. There's a lot of new growth also, so I'm not sure whether it's bugs and maybe just old junipers or they need to be fertilized in some way. I'm not kind of puzzled, but it looks kind of ratty.
Yeah, it's not a fertility issue. It should not be. They're pretty easy to grow. They're pretty adaptable, so that should not be an issue. As far as mites, Laura?
Right, so did you check for mites recently and saw some little tiny thing? So
little tiny ones, yeah.
Right. So that's probably, there's a spider mite, spruce spider mite, that we called a cool season mite. They tend to be pretty active when it's cool, and as soon as the weather gets warm, they're not very active anymore. Trouble is, there's not a whole lot of like miticides available. I mean, you can check products that are labeled for mites on juniper.
Someone said something about neem's oil. Do you know? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, neem. Yep, neem oil will work. It's getting good coverage, and you know, just double checking the label, especially with the conifer. Sometimes you want to make sure that that plant is definitely on the label, so you don't cause any damage to the plant from the product. But yeah, so if there, but it's definitely cool season. So if you check again and there's no activity, then you're going to want to wait again until fall, because they basically spend the whole summer as eggs and nothing works to kill
eggs.
Oh, so
wait until fall to spray?
Yeah, wait until, if we continue with this very warm weather, I would wait until fall to spray.
Okay. And my other question was, we're seeing in our house now what seemed to be a long ant, A-N-T, with long wings. It's kind of oblong rather than a fat one. And they're flying around our bedroom, and it's very distant.
Right. So I would definitely want to see a picture of that, because one of the things, you know, indoors, there's certainly winged ants, which, you know, are not that big a problem. But there's also winged termite swarmers. So this would be the time of the year. I got some several weeks ago. But that would be obviously a very serious pest that we'd want to determine for sure if it's winged ants or a winged swarmer. Can you email photos?
I think my husband can.
Okay.
We'll try and do that.
Okay, that would be great.
And whom do I email it to?
So our email is PIDC, so it's just for Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic, so PIDC at iastate.edu.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Looking forward to the pictures.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number. Ben is up next in Des Moines. Hi, Ben. Ben, are you there? All right. I guess Ben has dropped off. Let's go to Peter in Davenport. Hi, Peter.
Hi. My mom has lived in the same house since the 60s. The house was built in the 30s. The people that built it landscaped it. It has a cornelian cherry and a cucumber magnolia, both of which are kind of rare but beautiful trees. And I'm wondering how best I might be able to collect seeds and propagate them so the grandkids could have it from grandma's yard.
Okay. On the cucumber tree, they have this rather distorted fruit. And so wait till basically late summer, fall. Remove that and look for some seeds. They should be fairly large. And then basically what I would do is I would remove the seed and I would get some potting soil and I would moisten it and I would put some in a container and bury my seeds in that material, the moist potting soil, put on the lid, punch a couple holes in it, and then place it in the refrigerator. And basically leave it there for about 3 to 4 months, because when you're dealing with woody plants that are native to the Midwest, they typically, the seeds have to go through a cold, moist period before they can germinate. Typically it's winter, but I would do this indoors where it's more controlled, and then take them out in the spring, take the seeds out, plant the seeds at room temperature, the seeds should germinate in a few weeks. As far as the cornelian cherry dogwood, about the same thing, but the seeds are much, much smaller. So in that case, I think what I would do would be to And those fruit typically mature in midsummer or so. So remove those when they're mature. Take out the seeds, and then I would actually plant those in potting soil in a small flat. Just barely cover the seed, and then place them in the refrigerator again for basically 3 to 4 months. Take it out and see if they germinate.
And it is the refrigerator, not the freezer, right?
Right, the refrigerator, because you want temperatures that are just above freezing, so the refrigerator is perfect. It's ideal.
Great.
All right, good luck with that project.
I'm sorry I didn't have a bug question. Thank you very much.
Maybe next time. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. All right, here's an email from Babs. My husband and I were just in California, and he fell in love with the yucca plant. Is there any way to grow it in Iowa? We live in southeastern Iowa.
Well, the yucca is actually native to far western Iowa. You'll see it on the slopes of the Luss Hills, typically on the west-facing slopes where it's very hot and very dry. So it's actually native to Iowa. And we can definitely grow the yucca.
All right. So you don't have to go to California for it. All right. Here's a question from Anne. We have a pear tree that has a black fungus, maybe in the middle branch, about a foot long. What is that? How should we treat it?
Boy, you stumped me. I don't know. I definitely will appreciate seeing some pictures of this because... is it more like a conch, like something that sticks out? Yeah, I have so many questions.
All right. So you need more information to work with on that one. Here's an email from Adam. He said, should soil testing be done before selecting a garden site? My home is in Iowa City. It was built in the 1950s, and I'm concerned about the possibility of toxic substances such as motor oil, etc., having been dumped by previous owners.
And a soil test, a typical soil test, would not reveal that. If you send a soil sample to the ISU soil testing lab, they look at nutrients. How much phosphate do you have? How much potash do you have? What's your soil pH? How much organic matter do you have? They really don't look for contaminants. You would have to contact a private lab for that. And you typically have to be a little bit specific as far as what you're looking for.
Sure.
Where you contact them and say, could you look for possibly any type of oil or gas or maybe lead or something of that nature? So
now, of course, if let's say you're thinking about a garden plot that maybe is where a previous owner parked a car and you know that, I mean, that would be concerning, right?
Right. It would be concerning. The other thing would be maybe to dig up the area and maybe just plant a few things, like maybe some flowers, maybe some annual flowers like marigolds, zinnias, whatever. And see how they perform kind of as a test to see how they do.
All right. Here are a couple questions from Kevin. One for you, Richard. He says, I'm going to espalier, I don't know how to say that, train some apples. So put apples up on a trellis, right? And with a post and wire system, I'm going to bury posts in quickcrete or concrete, which would be 6 feet from the trunk. Do I need to worry about toxicity of concrete?
Shouldn't have to, no.
All right. And this one's for Lena and Laura. I have several 8 to 9 foot Mohican viburnum. In the past few years, I seem to lose one or two. Leaves are very stunted when leafing out, reddish brown color in the middle of the leaves. They're in a well-drained soil. What should I be looking for?
One thing to check for, there's a viburnum crown borer, which can cause kind of branch dieback and whole plant kind of unthriftiness. It's a clearwing moth, so a caterpillar, and it feeds right at the base of the branches. It's pretty obvious. Well, if you get down there and kind of dig them out and you can peel the bark off and it looks like there's something literally kind of fed on the wood there, that's very likely the viburnum crown borer, which is difficult to control. But other than that, I think the next step would be to send us some pictures and we can see, you know, if a sample would be useful if we want to test for any diseases or things like that.
All right, let's get back to the phones. Karen is up next in Iowa City. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Oh, thank you so much for being there.
Oh, sure.
I am doing some hardscaping in my yard, and it's supposed to happen within about 2 weeks. You were talking about peonies. I have two beautiful peony bushes to move. And if I have to move them now, what can I do to optimize the outcome of that?
Okay. Can they go right back in the ground, or do they have
yes,
to stay out?
Yes, they can.
Okay. Then what I would do is I would go out in the evening, and I would dig them up, and I would put them back as soon as I could. Now, if you can't, what I would do is simply put them in a pot, a big pot, and they can stay in that pot for several weeks or a few months. But I would put them in that pot. I would put them in the shade where they're out of the direct sun, keep them out of the wind, keep them well watered, and they should survive just fine. And then later on, you can put them in the ground. But if you do it, I would do it in the evening and put them right back in the ground if you can, keep them well watered. And I would try to shade them if you're actually going to do it immediately. Shade them from the sun the next few days after transplanting. Maybe use a cardboard box or something where they're shaded during the heat of the day. Because when you move them, even though you might dig them up with a nice ball of dirt, you're going to injure the plants and they're going to have a hard time getting enough water. So if you can maybe shade them for a few days, that would help.
Thank you so much.
Good luck, Karen. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Tom in Maquoketa. Hi, Tom.
Thank you. I have a quick question. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, I have, I believe it's an autumn purple ash, about 24 inches the trunk in diameter. In the last few years, I've been getting these clusters of acorn size. I'm not even sure what they are, but they're all over the tree. They last all winter, and obviously they drop off, it seems like, all year round. They're extremely messy, but it's unusual because it just seems like it's been happening the last few years, and I'm not about to do a lot of heavy treatment on this tree, noting that the emerald ash borer is coming through the state, but I just wonder, is the tree under stress, or what are these things?
Well, that's actually really, it's a cool, to me, okay, everything is cool to me. So these are a mite-caused gall, and it's actually called the ash flower gall. So this tree, the flowers are coming out, and these tiny little mites that you can't see, and they look like tiny little crawling carrots, and they start feeding in the flowers, and then they cause that distorted tissue their feeding does. And this group of mites, the areophyid mites, this is very typical of them, is to cause weird distortion in plants. It was very obvious last year. We got a lot of samples in it. So the kind of how bad it is will depend a little bit on, you know, the overwintering survival of the mite and the mite's population. But harmless to the tree. It's just the male flowers are just kind of funny looking.
And kind of messy.
Well, I certainly enjoy your show, and your resident experts are extremely informative to us homeowners and gardeners.
Oh, well, thanks a lot for your call, Tom. It's nice to hear something that's not going to kill an ash tree. That's refreshing these days. All right, we're almost out of time, but let's try this one. This is from Deb. Someone wants to give me a couple of clematis plants. When is the best time and the best way to move them into my yard?
I would say very early in the spring, probably around early to mid-April.
All right, and her second question is, why isn't my knockout rose coming back? Have you heard a lot about that this spring?
Actually. We had a mild winter, so they typically do quite well. If there's no sign of life at all, I have no idea. Winter should not have killed them. It shouldn't have, so I don't know.
All right, so maybe that's a question for Lena and Laura, but probably go on your website and find some more information. Laura Iles, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Laura Iles is director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca, thank you.
Thank you.
Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca is an extension plant pathologist and diagnostician. And Richard Giron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron. We will be back on the air next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.